today when we see the challenge of different ideas responded to as if they are a threat to national or international security, I think it should ring bells. When ideas are responded to with military force, what is going on? What is being protected? And who is being protected? This experience from the 1200s ought to be known because it provides so many different lenses through which to look at what is happening today and have an understanding of what the world looks like when it's governed in the interests of the 1% rather than the interests of the 99%. There was something about the Cathars which the Roman Catholic leadership of the 13th century regarded with such horror and contempt that a papal campaign was launched, a military campaign that lasted more than 100 years, a campaign prosecuted by 19 successive popes determined to assassinate every single Cathar in Europe. The church was saying, suppress your own thoughts, suppress your own judgment, do what we tell you unquestioningly, and it will be rewarded. And it was that kind of instruction and that kind of compliance that led to the world's first. Do you ever feel as if you have an invisible team of helpers whose job is to guide you through life and that they occasionally whisper inspirations and ideas to you to support your progress through life? Do you ever wonder if your occasional flashes of genius are actually being fed to you by another version of yourself, a higher self, or your subconscious? Do you sometimes feel that you don't really belong here, that your true home is far away among the stars? Do you sometimes feel that you have memories of another life, or that you may have been a different gender in another life? Do you feel deeply that the genders are equal, including with regard to leadership? Do you believe that animals have souls and feel so compassionate towards our fellow animals that you really struggle with the idea of eating them? Do you feel that you are sharper, more alert, more creative, better able to think clearly when you fast or eat more lightly? On a more theological note, do you, like me, believe that the God figure in the Old Testament is really a very dark, violent and anti-human presence in the biblical story? Are you, like me, disturbed by the way the cross has been used through the ages as a symbol of empire, colonization, enslavements, and all kinds of violence? Do you, like me, believe that spirituality or a life of prayer can be expressed without the need to be sucked into religion or churchianity? If you think some or all of those things, then right now you are in the flow of Cathar thought. To some, these ideas may seem rather obvious. To others, these kinds of ideas are an assault and a threat to Orthodox religious belief. In the 11th to 13th centuries, these ideas and the people who held them were so threatening that 19 successive popes dispatched armies for more than 100 years, chiefly to the south of France, until as many as 1 million people, men, women, and children, had been wiped from the face of the earth. And not just for believing these things, but for living in the same town with people who believed these things. The Cathars represented a spiritual tradition which flowered in the 11th to 13th centuries in Italy and in the Languedoc in the south of France. Their beliefs and their way of life differed from those of medieval Catholicism. In a Europe rife with crime and violence, Cathar communities became renowned for their peaceful, productive, and egalitarian life. In fact, Cathar communities were so functional and healthy that their neighbors referred to them as the Cathars, which means the pure ones or the good people. But there was something about the Cathars which the Roman Catholic leadership of the 13th century regarded with such horror and contempt that a papal campaign was launched, a military campaign that lasted more than 100 years, a campaign prosecuted by 19 successive popes determined to assassinate every single Cathar in Europe. When the papal campaign arrived at the town of Béziers, the military forces had a problem. Now, Béziers was a town of around 20,000 people, among whom about 200 were Cathars. And so this threw up the obvious question: how do we tell which are the Cathars and which are the regular Catholics? The military command of this assault was a Benedictine monk, not the sort of person you'd expect to be leading an army, but indeed he was, and his name was Arnaud Almaric. When his officers approached him to say, "How do we know who to kill?" his answer went down in history: "Kill them all. God will recognize his own." That gives you some idea of the sense of urgency in this 100-year campaign and the brutality that church forces brought to the matter. The impact of the slaughter of the Cathars was so great that by the end of the 1200s, it's estimated that between 500,000 and 1,000,000 French people had been killed. And to give you a sense of scale, it reduced the world's population by 0.26%. That's more than four times the impact of the Second World War, to put it in proportion. And this wasn't the policy of one bad apple who happened to become pope. This was 19 successive popes prosecuting the same policy for more than a century in order to rid the world of Cathar people and Cathar thought. Many historians refer to this campaign as the world's first genocide, and it was all the invention of the church in Rome. And yet, when I was training for the ministry four decades ago, this is how I learned about Catharism. Now, these are the kinds of books that priests and pastors use when they are learning about the institution into which they're being ordained. And so I picked up this one, The Penguin History of the Church, Western Society and the Church in the Middle Ages. This little section here, down here, and on the top of this page, that is how this book summarizes the Cathar course. It says, in this extensive sense, the medieval church was a state. It had all the apparatus of a state: law and law courts, taxes and tax collectors, a great administrative machine, power of life and death over the citizens of Christendom and their enemies within and without. But we must remember, those who bore authority in the church were agents with very limited powers of initiative. They were not free agents. Doubtless they were responsible for some terrible acts of violence and cruelty, among which the Albigensian Crusade holds a position of peculiar horror. And those last seven words with regard to the Albigensian Crusade are the only reference in this thick book to the obliteration of the Cathars. Let's try another history book. This is the Concise Dictionary of Christian Tradition, published by Marshall Pickering. Again, quite a thick book. And right here, that little paragraph is all it has to say about this 100 years episode. The Cathars, it says, a heretical Christian sect. Now, we all know history is written by the winners, so as soon as I read a heretical Christian sect, that's a red flag for me. Heretical Christian sect. While the name had been held by some earlier groups, it is generally associated in Western Europe with a movement known in France by 1017 that seems to have links with the Bogomils of 10th century Bulgaria. They repudiated matter as evil, rejected sex and procreation, repudiated the incarnation and the resurrection, and approved of suicide and usury. The sect did not survive the 14th century Inquisition. First off, we should recognize that's an orthodox summary of Cathar belief, so it's the enemies of the Cathars describing what they were into, so we should take all that with a pinch of salt. But that phrase at the end, did not survive the Inquisition, that's how this book, again, thick, serious history book, summarizes 100 years of assault by the church's militia to eradicate an entire people group from the face of the earth. It says did not survive the Inquisition as if they just gave up and went home. Can anyone say cover up? Let's try another book. This one is The Study of Spirituality by SPCK, an even thicker book. Let's see how much of a mention the Cathars get here. Here it's talking about the period of the mendicants. That's the Franciscans, the Poor Clares, and the Dominicans, who began flowering in the 1200s, again that same period. And it says here, the two most important movements on the fringe of the church were the Cathars and the Waldensians. The Cathars seem to have preached a version of dualism, derived from the Bogomils in Bulgaria, and little is known of their spirituality. It is likely that most of their ordinary followers were impressed by the austerity of their lives rather than by their doctrine, and it has been suggested that their main attraction was their promise of safe conduct to heaven after death, a widespread concern in this period. What do you make of that? People were joining not because they really believed the things, but they liked the lifestyle, and we don't know much about what they believed. We actually know a fair amount about what the Cathars believed and why the mainstream Catholic Church took such offence at them. I first learned about the Cathars when I was studying up on the Franciscans and the Poor Clares and the Dominicans. And in fact, St. Dominic, who was the founder of the Dominican order, intersects with the story of the Cathars in a rather interesting way. Now, I have a soft spot for Dominic and the Dominicans, and people who know how this story plays out might be shocked to hear me say that, because there is darkness in the Dominican story through the centuries, but there is light in it too. And the light is there, this golden thread, really because of the character and the values of the person who founded the order. Why it was founded has everything to do with the Cathars. But just to illustrate, Dominic Guzman, we'll find out a little bit more about him in a moment, created this order, and within that order we have some amazing people emerging at later times. Without the Dominican order, there would have been no Francisco Jimenez. And he is the person who translated the Mayan story of origins into Spanish in the very early 1700s, so that all of a sudden, anyone who could speak Spanish had a very different account of humanity and human origins. And we have a lot to thank Francisco Jimenez for, a Dominican friar. In the 1500s, Giordano Bruno was the flower of the Dominican movement. He toured Europe giving lectures, teaching people how to access more of their cognitive powers and teaching them about the populated universe that we occupy. And he was a great proponent of the Copernican Revolution, understanding the nature of the movements of the planets and stars. Again, a flower of the Dominican movement. They emerged because Dominic, right at the beginning, taught his followers to be readers and scholars, to listen to other traditions, to learn from indigenous people, to always pursue truth and knowledge, and to love the communities in which they lived. But his story begins with the church's concern about the Cathars. To set the scene for the church's grave concern about this beautiful spiritual movement in the Languedoc, we have to realize that the 1200s was a period in which the Catholic Church was losing a whole generation. This was a generation of young people who had been deployed in a sequence of crusades. And when they came back from those wars, their world had changed. Suddenly they had a completely different understanding of the powers and of their own place in a world run by the 1%. They realized these wars were nothing to do with theology or the honor of Jesus Christ. They were to do with moving power and control and wealth from one set of powerful families to another set of powerful families. And they, the knights and soldiers and warriors, members of the middle and merchant classes, were nothing but pawns to further enrich the 1%. And they had gone to war, they'd seen and done horrible things, their friends had been killed, and when they came back, they wanted nothing to do with this kind of society. And so they were buying out of medieval Catholicism at an enormous rate all across Europe. And so, back in Rome, the Curia was very jittery about how do we not lose the plot? How do we survive for another generation? How do we retain this generation that is exiting at a rate of knots? And the Cathars were just one of a number of groups who represented a non-Catholic alternative to the Roman Catholic mainstream. Now, many of the young people, particularly of the merchant class, who were exiting medieval Catholicism, were joining new movements, and the Franciscan movement in particular. And they gathered together, they lived in poverty, they lived subsistence lives, they lived lives of simplicity, where they did not use money, and were not frightened of threats of hell by the institution of the church, where they didn't need priests to teach them what was what or to provide them with the sacraments. And so these alternative centers of gravity for young community were popping up all across Europe. Now, Pope Innocent III wanted to do something about that, to pull these people back into the fold. Pope Innocent III regarded this mass exodus from the norms of medieval life as a matter of grave concern. To the Curia, it appeared as a threat to the general social order, and specifically to Rome's place within that order. After some conversation with the close comrades of Francis of Assisi, the Curia managed to find a way to accommodate some of the movement's leaders. The Curia would essentially anchor the simple hierarchy operating within the flocks of the Franciscans and Poor Clares. This was done by formally recognizing the movement's leaders and those who gathered around them as a quasi-monastic order. The order's members would be given the ecclesiastical label of penitents. In the language of the day, this was like saying, these are people with issues to whom we'll extend some special tolerance and grace because they're in recovery and are doing penance for their sins. It was a neat and tidy way of recognizing the mendicant networks, rationalizing their radical lifestyle, and affirming them without giving them any authority in the fabric of the church. It was a neat fix. However, the phenomenon of Catharism in the Languedoc proved a harder nut to crack. What Innocent III did was to send ambassadors into the Languedoc who were senior Benedictine leaders. And so they arrived on horseback in all their ecclesiastical finery to teach the correct doctrines and teach the true understanding of things to to the local people, but found they weren't making much headway. And after a failed attempt at reconverting the south of France, they gathered together in Montpellier, and they were rather downhearted. And it was here that they met a Spanish bishop, Diego of Azevedo, and his PA, Dominic Guzman, an Augustinian friar. And as they listened to these three senior Cistercian Benedictine monastic leaders, the young Dominic said, "Well, isn't it obvious why you failed? You are offering the Cathars precisely what they don't want. They don't believe in hierarchy, and you're representing hierarchy. They live a simple, humble life. You arrive on horseback, dressed like that. They have a beautiful, peaceful, egalitarian life, and you're going in almost like military leaders, telling them what's what, and that they need to get their act together and do as they're told. This is completely what the Cathars don't want. If we are going to win the Cathars, you need to take all those vestments off. You need to arrive on foot. You need to live simply. And you need to have a powerful connection with God, a spirituality that is so pure and palpable that it will be more impressive than what the Cathar leaders have. You need to out-Cathar the Cathars, become like them if you're going to win them and have something every bit as humble and real and life-changing and empowering as what they have." Well, by the time Dominic had finished his speech, the three Cistercian monks realized, I don't think we can pull that off. And within a matter of weeks, the mission to the Cathars had been handed over to Diego of Azevedo and his PA. Now, within a couple of years, Diego had passed away, and the mission was inherited by Dominic Guzman. He set up his base in Toulouse in France, and he taught his followers to love the local people genuinely, to learn from them, to learn to live like them, to understand what it was they had, and then learn to live that way for themselves. This is the golden thread in the Dominican movement. These were the beautiful values that Dominic sowed in to Dominicanism. And so this is what they did. They lived together in community. They taught. They modeled a way of life. They said, "Look, this is pretty much what you guys have, but you can do it all within the frame of Catholicism. We're all very obedient and devout to the Pope, and yet we live like you." But in the end, what Dominic and his followers were offering was surplus to requirements in the south of France. The Cathars were already happy. They were already the pure ones, the good people. They didn't need what the Dominicans were offering. And so when Pope Innocent III realized that the Dominican mission to the Cathars had failed, he sent in the army. But where did the power and the wisdom of the Cathars come from? You can find the roots of Catharism in the teachings of Plato. Now, Plato taught that we are primarily beings of consciousness, and that we pre-exist this material life as aspects of the consciousness of the cosmos. We then individuate and become material beings, forgetting what we knew before. Because as aspects of the consciousness of the cosmos, it means there was a time when we knew everything. But we come into this material life and we forget all that. And this life becomes a process of learning. And everything we learn is really a remembering of what we knew before when we were aspects of the source. And so the whole of life is about ascension, learning to have a better human experience, to know things more truly as they are, to become a better kind of human being. This process includes tuning into the wisdom of interdimensional guides who assist us in our progress through life, who can be contacted through altered states of consciousness, and who give us coaching as we move towards and through death. They're the ones who do our life review with us, who, when we pass away, come around us and say, "So how do you feel that went?" and give us guidance for what's to come next. Plato believed in all kinds of other entities, including those who live on islands, in the sky, those who live in space, the interdimensional beings, and the craftsman, the demiurge, a powerful kind of entity involved in terraforming of our planet in the deep past. It was a very interesting worldview that Plato taught, and many of the early church fathers lived and breathed that worldview, and they read the Bible in the light of that worldview. And so they understood that the Bible held stories of contact with these other kinds of entities and gave us teachings that would help support our life of progress and ascension in this material life. Now, this is very much the worldview of the Cathars, and it is as if all those ideas of Plato ultimately flowered in the practice of the Cathars in the 1200s. In Plato's Timaeus and Critias, he writes this: "We should think of the most authoritative part of our soul as if it were a guardian spirit given to each one of us by God, living in the summit of the body, which can properly be said to lift us from the earth towards our true home in heaven, as if we were a heavenly and not an earthbound plant." It is as if the Cathars took that understanding and turned it into a whole way of life. Plato's idea that we're originally beings of consciousness and then we come into this material life and forget everything we knew before, and now we learn and it's an act of remembering, they turned that into a lifestyle and a set of practices. They believed that our cosmic self, our light body, our the highest version of ourselves, still exists, feeding information to our material selves on planet Earth, and that our flashes of genius are really coming from our light body, our higher self, that when we progress from one state of being to a better state of being, it's because we are becoming more like our light body. And so this comes back to where we began, these flashes of inspiration being fed from a higher version of ourselves. And to help with that connection, they changed their diet, they fasted, they ate more lightly, they avoided all meat. The only meat they would eat was fish, because they didn't believe that fish had souls in the same way that the other land animals did. This was part of a medieval worldview. But they had a great sense of fellow feeling with animals who they believed had souls, and so they wouldn't eat them. They had other practices, all designed to make themselves more alert to the information flowing to them from their light bodies, with the goal of becoming a better kind of person, a better kind of human, more conscious, more intelligent, leading to a better human life, and not only on an individual level, but a better life as a society. In a Europe marred by crime and violence, the Cathars lived peaceful lives, each one using their skills and their physical labor for the betterment of society as a whole. They were egalitarian and believed in the equality of men and women, including in leadership. They ate a pescatarian diet, avoiding meat, poultry, eggs, and dairy, because they believed that animals have souls too. They didn't teach church-going, but instead scattered prayer throughout their rhythm of the day. They venerated Jesus and sought to live by his teachings, but denied the need for rituals like baptism and the Eucharist. They had no fear of hell or divine punishment, but held to the Platonic view that we are essentially beings of consciousness, and that as conscious beings, we are aspects of the consciousness of the cosmos itself. As such, our conscious life precedes this material life and survives our physical death to go on to other adventures, either here on Earth or elsewhere in the cosmos or in other dimensions. The Cathars organized their lives around these ideas, shaping their diet attitudes and ways of life around heightening each person's conscious connection with their light body, all of which led to a peaceable, calm, and compassionate society. The Cathars read the Old Testament very differently from the way it was taught in mainstream Catholicism. The Cathars believed that the God of the Old Testament was a very dark, violent, brutal, and anti-human presence in the human story and was not the true God. And they contrasted the God of the Old Testament with true God. They also implicitly contrasted the Church of Rome with what they regarded as true church. The Cathars described themselves as the Church of Amor, A-M-O-R, the Latin for love. They were the Church of Love, a loving community. That was what church was for them. It was Rome spelt backwards. So you have the Church of Roma or the Church of Amor. And I think that was taken as a direct shot at the Roman Curia and a claim that nobody needed its ministrations. And these were the ideas that Pope Innocent III and all those who came after him, those 19 successive popes, believed they had to shoot down in flames before that idea could take hold. Of course, Christians aren't supposed to kill one another, according to the teachings of Jesus, and so the Pope had to create a huge incentive to persuade people to join the militia and go round killing their Cathar neighbours. And so this was the deal, that if you would become part of this militia, part of this killing machine, for 40 days, you as a soldier had the right to take hold of properties and lands that previously belonged to the Cathars. And the commanding officers could redistribute these possessions to members of the army. So there's a huge promise of wealth that would have been quite beyond the reach of many who joined the papal armies before they did that. But also, you would be forgiven for killing people because the Pope would give you guaranteed entry into heaven. So, I mean, who could complain at that? Wealth in this life, heaven in the next, and all you've got to do is kill a few Cathars for 40 days. That was the deal. There was only one caveat. You had to vow obedience to the Pope and the King of France. And so that was the issue. The Pope and the King of France wanted land and property to be owned only by people who would do what they told them and believe what they said. For them, this was a struggle about power and control. Control of lands and power over people's minds. I think that's very interesting because what essentially the church was doing was taking people who had minds and a conscience and could see there might be a problem with murdering people in their own towns or neighboring towns. And the church was saying, suppress your own thoughts, suppress your own judgment, do what we tell you unquestioningly, and it will be rewarded. And it was that kind of instruction and that kind of compliance that led to the world's first genocide. Now, does that ring any bells? And when I come back to my history books, I have to realize they were all written after the Second World War, another moment where we saw where that kind of logic led. And there may have been a conscience in these post-war writers, realizing that this ethic that leads to such horrors was something pioneered by the church and was prosecuted by the church through the ages. Maybe pastors and priests training for the ministry, preparing to be ordained into that institution, don't need to know that. And I wonder if that's why there's a real dumbing down and a hiding of what happened in the official history books. And yet the information is still out there if you have the impulse to go and look. I think today, when we see the challenge of different ideas responded to as if they are a threat to national or international security, I think it should ring bells. When ideas are responded to with military force, what is going on? What is being protected? And who is being protected? I think this experience from the 1200s ought to be known because it provides so many different lenses through which to look at what is happening today and have an understanding of what the world looks like when it's governed in the interests of the 1% rather than the interests of the 99%. In my book, Echoes of Eden, I show how empowering ancestral narratives, such as the ones the Cathars ran with, have been fiercely suppressed through all the ages. And yet somehow, the forbidden wisdom of the ages always finds a way to survive and persist. And Catharism is a case in point. A little more than 100 years after the execution of the last Cathar leader, Marsilio Ficino was born. And he was a scholar and a priest. And like Dominic Guzman, Francisco Jimenez, Giordano Bruno, he was a linguist as well as a theologian and became what we can call a Renaissance man, a scholar across all kinds of subjects. And using his linguistic skills, he went to Plato and the Corpus Hermeticum and he translated them into Latin. Now, those texts that were so important to the Cathars had been lost for a long time. They weren't part of mainstream scholarship or public conversation. People didn't really know about them. Marsilio Ficino, by translating them into Latin, suddenly brings these ideas, these other ideas about human potential and our place in the cosmos, to a readership that was ballooning across Europe. This is a period after the invention of the printing press. So all of a sudden, there are readers around the world who can get hold of copies of Plato, copies of the Corpus Hermeticum. And so the ideas that had flourished and flowered as Catharism were suddenly in circulation again. So although Catharism, as a working society, didn't survive the Inquisition, to use that neat little phrase, their ideas did. So much so that many of their ideas have survived to the present. So if you're not afraid of hell and regard that as a made-up idea, if you regard the God of the Old Testament as a distortion or an entirely different figure altogether, nothing to do with the source of the cosmos, if you appreciate the figure of Jesus but don't agree with the need to go to church or perform religious rituals, if you believe women are equal to men, including as leaders, if you see prayer as nurturing a connection with the divine in nature and in your day-to-day life, if you want to tune in to the insights and moments of guidance that seem to flow to you from a higher version of yourself, you're in the flow of Cathar thought. You're participating in ideas that Marsilio Ficino brought back into mainstream conversation. When I pick up a book and it tells me Catharism, a heretical Christian sect, it's a red flag that tells me to look again. And I think when we look again, we might not agree with everything they believed or want to replicate all their practices, but we will recognize that these were people who transformed their lives through taking hold of beliefs that were not mainstream, that were extracurricular, and yet were rooted in ancient ancestral wisdom. This was information that had the power to change their lives individually and as a society. And I find it tremendously exciting that we have access to those ideas today. This is why I love having books like the Corpus Hermeticum and books by Plato on my shelves, because somehow this information has always survived to prepare us for a better human experience, individually and as a society. As more and more people get excited again about works like the works of Plato and the Corpus Hermeticum, it makes me wonder about the present day. Could it be that, like the Cathars of 1,000 years ago, we today are beginning to remember who we really are? Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. Remember to subscribe and click on the bell for notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content. For uncensored access to our full interviews and documentaries, go to fifthkind.tv. For more videos concerning Paleo Contact and the wisdom of the world's ancestral narratives, go to the Paul Wallace channel, subscribe, and click on the bell for notifications. Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV.